All right. What you're noticing on the board is what's kind of striking me. The outline that you guys did, do you remember the reason why I was having you do the outlines? What was the point of that? Big picture. I want you to know or to wrestle with how the different elements in Mark fit together. And this is one of the things that I've noticed in my own study of what seems to be happening in the opening chapters with Mark, is you see this kind of pattern develop of word, deed, demonic conflict, word, deed, demonic conflict. And now you're going to sit there and if you dissect it too closely, then you may say, that doesn't seem exactly right. The general pattern, however, is that you see an initial word that is proclaimed. And that word usually is so controversial or so audacious that it needs a deed to justify what he's just said. Does that make sense? Usually the deed is going to be in some sense miraculous, like we saw here how this is in the literally that's within a context of miracles. But something astounding that would get people's attention and also point back to what he initially was talking about. So here the calling disciples does point back to this because he's enlisting his army and it's done in a way that's even orchestrated literally in kind of a miraculous type setting. And then you also, what's really interesting is after you see the word validated by the deed, which reinforces the word in some symbiotic relationship, you usually see a demonic controversy shortly thereafter. So you have Jesus proclaims the coming of the kingdom in 1:15, whenever he, my notes aren't even open. Whenever he loudly proclaims the kingdom of God is near. And then right after that, you see the deed of the calling of the conflict, or the calling of the, calling of the disciples in 1:16 through 20, which is immediately followed up by exorcisms in Capernaum, which is one of the first times where we hear Jesus identified accurately by the demonic figures, right? Remember that? In what chapter quiz? These may be good, you know? Oh, where's the first demonic conflict? 1:21 through 28. Then what you also see is y'all see the Sabbath. Whenever we move into chapter 2, you see the Sabbath teaching where Jesus says, don't you know that even the Son of Man is Lord of also the Sabbath? Man wasn't made for Sabbath. Sabbath was made for the man. Pretty controversial teaching, which then is justified with the man with the shriveled hand healing in the synagogue in chapter 3, verses 5 through 6, which is followed up shortly thereafter by the Beelzebub controversy. And what we're going to see today is we've already gone through the four kingdom parables where Jesus is describing the pervasiveness, the power, the function of the kingdom, the way it will be received, the parable of the sowers, which is then followed up by him calming the storm. And then today we're going to interact with the Gerasim demoniac, the conflict there in the area of Gerasim, which Matthew, we will find out, calls Gadara. What is the significance of this pattern? If there is a literary pattern, there's usually a theological literary point. It's not just a nice little way to organize material. What's the purpose of it? What's the significance? What do you see? Just dream with me for a minute. What could possibly be the purpose of Mark developing something like this?
The words and deeds of Christ so that it can fight against the demonic conflict?
Okay, so maybe the words and deeds themselves are the way in which he is fighting against the demonic conflict. Sure, absolutely. What else?
Mm-hmm. I mean, the very actions give life to his words.
Explain that further, yeah.
His teaching of the kingdom and mm-hmm. the parables. Even his, the very casting out of the demons or calming the storms, the power, on one hand, is like a stamp. Approving it, but I mean, on the other hand, really give meaning to it. So, for example, I'm writing my passage on Mark 7,
yeah,
and the hand washing incident. He does this hand washing kind of talk, this controversy with the teachers of the law, and what happens right afterwards is he goes and interacts with those on the fringes of Israel's community. And what I'm going to talk about is how those very things illustrate what he was talking about in the hand-washing thing. Because the hand-washing thing is an issue of national identity.
Absolutely.
National boundaries. So for him to make that proclamation, you think, why in the world is he just talking about washing hands? Why is it such a big deal? you do a little background search about ritual purity and this interaction with national identity, and then he goes straight to those people who would be on the fringes, and feels that when you even have that instant with the woman,
the Syrophoenician woman, yeah,
from the table of, you know, table of Israel. So
absolutely, and you're exactly right. And chapter 7 is a good example of this, because you see this initial talking of clean and unclean, which for us isn't all that exhilarating. We're just going, okay, ritual purity. Jesus put all that to death. We don't need to talk about it. But the implications of what he is talking about is played out with the Syrophoenician woman, which is one of the reasons why I think that Jesus' response to the Syrophoenician woman, I don't think is his true response. I think he is enacting what the disciples thought he should be enacting. And he does it as a means of rebuking them, in a sense, and teaching them about clean and unclean. But we'll get to that in chapter 7. But you're exactly right. What's happening leading into these demonic conflicts, usually these are in some sense illustrated or lived out right here. Because what's he talking about in these three areas? What's his main focus? He's establishing a kingdom by enlisting soldiers. And ultimately, his kingdom will be in conflict with the demonic kingdom. The Sabbath teaching, saying, I am establishing a kingdom that is going to be connected to Israel, but it's going to restore it to what it really has never been. This needs to be mandated because he is overriding some of the key identifying rituals of the Jewish people. Therefore, it is validated. Ultimately, though, his doing this, his restructuring of Israel, is something that is directly in conflict with Satanic kingdom. As a result, the Beelzebub controversy. And that's what you find here. Kingdom parables, this is the way my kingdom functions. This is the way my kingdom rolls. And then he comes here and he says they have a conflict on the storm, in a sense, with Satan, where he calms the storm. But in case somebody missed that evil confrontation, we're going to see one more explicit right here with the Gerasene demoniac. See how that's developing? If you're establishing a kingdom of God, it will inevitably be in a conflict with the kingdoms that are claiming territory of where you're establishing. Remember our definition of conflict? Conflict is where two people or two kingdoms try to occupy the exact same space at the exact same time. It's where two people or two kingdoms try to occupy the exact same space at the exact same time. And that space that they occupy could be geographical, it could be theological. Nevertheless, conflict occurs whenever they try to overlap. And that's what's happening. There's an overlapping of Jesus' kingdom with the kingdom of Satan, which equals conflict. So the pattern's on purpose. It's a natural outworking of Jesus' ministry. Because he's coming to establish a kingdom, and Satan's kingdom's not just going to sit by idly and allowing him to do that. All right, chapter 5, verse 1. They went across the lake. What's the lake? Sea of Galilee. It's almost going to become our Jesus answer. Jesus. They went across the lake to the region of the Gerasenes. Okay, where is the region of the Gerasenes? We don't really know. We have a good guess, but we don't really know the region of the Gerasenes. This is actually the reason why Matthew chapter 8, the parallel passage, Matthew 8, 28 through 34, does help us. Because he doesn't call it the region of the Gerasenes, he calls it Gadara, or the Gadarene. And there we see on this map, the region of Gadara is right around here. Jesus more than likely is over in this region of the Sea of Galilee. He crosses down here through. Remember what gets him over here, though. What gets him over there? The boat, yes. The storm. This is where they land after the storm. But here's Gadara, and more than likely this would be the region of Gennesaret. But notice the overarching region that we're dealing with here. What are we dealing with? The Decapolis. What do we know about the Decapolis? Yes, very Hellenistic. Why? Yeah, there are a lot of Greeks who live, but also, remember, we talked about when you're on the fringes of an empire, or whenever, my example of this is the English colonies, like in the Philippines. Whenever you're displaced from the central location of the empire, you usually overemphasize your connection to the empire. And the reason for that is to make sure, number one, that the empire knows that even though you're not living in the key location of the empire, that you are still committed to it. And number two, to make sure you are separating yourself from the people in your region. So the Decapolis is highly Hellenized as a means of preserving their identity and distinguishing themselves from the other people around them. Does that make sense sociologically? You follow me there? Yeah. It's kind of like one of those things whenever you move away from home, you didn't really have much of an accent, but your accent sometimes gets thicker. And the reason why is because in a sense you're trying to reestablish your identity of belonging to a place that is foreign from the one that you're at. Same thing happening here. Decapolis, highly Hellenized, highly Romanized. And that will be very significant, I think, once we get into the conflict that occurs. So let's keep reading. So they went across the region of the lake to the region, or they went across the lake to the region of the Gerasenes. When Jesus got out of the boat, a man with an evil spirit came from the tombs to meet him. We're going to be really talking a little bit today and kind of looking at the strategies or the key tactics of the satanic kingdom. Because it reveals itself very clearly just in the description of this person. And what you'll find is whenever you're seeing the person, the demoniac, described and the tactics that are revealed through just his mere description, you'll see a lot of similarities with the satanic kingdom today. Basically, this is the point of those parallels. He's using the same tricks he's always used. And the problem is they're still stinking effective. Two of his primary weapons, two significant things that characterize the kingdom of Satan. Number one is death. Where does this guy come from? The tombs. That's where he dwells. That's where he lives. This one of the key weapons of the satanic kingdom is death. Both the physical act of it and the fear that is incited from people that don't want to meet death. One of the things, matter of fact, this is even one of the things that marketers and even political pundits have started to finally tap into the power of fear. If you really want to move an entire people in a direction, you incite fear in them. And ultimately, then they will move, just out of the very desire for self-preservation. And fear, the fear of death, one of the ways in which Satan can get in a mass amount of people to do things for his kingdom is to incite fear in them using the element of death. Therefore, if he can say, this person's going to kill you, from people that aren't Christians, or that aren't in this room, I'm not going to act like that you would do this, but if they're saying, like, this group's going to kill you, the reaction of this group then will be, to, out of the fear, to try and kill them so that they can preserve themselves from death. See how that weapon works? It's the same thing he's been using for kingdoms after kingdoms after kingdoms all throughout history. If you don't kill them first, they will kill you. Well, we better just wipe them out. Because why? They're afraid of dying. They're fear of death. Satan's kingdom is usually in some way, shape, or form connected to death. Some way, shape, or form. Even in our day and age today, a lot of times the different rituals of Satanists and things of that nature revolve around the dead, talking to the dead, around tombs, etc. Does that make sense? The second thing that you'll see when this description really begins to develop is one of Satan's key weapons, one of his other significant characteristics is violence. You'll see this in a moment whenever the guy is, he doesn't know what else to do but to cut himself with potsherds, with clay potsherds. Matter of fact, in Matthew chapter 11, this is really interesting to me. Matthew chapter 11, John the Baptist, this is where John the Baptist has been in prison. Jesus' ministry has been going strong for 7 chapters in Matthew at that point. And what happens? John the Baptist sends a contingent of his disciples and he says, they say, John the Baptist wants to know if you really are the one or if we should be waiting for someone else. And my initial question is, what's the deal? Why is John the Baptist all of a sudden freaking out? What's wrong with him? I mean, he said this was the Messiah and Jesus says, yes, that's me. He said a kingdom is going to be established through the Messiah and Jesus says, yeah, I'm going to establish that kingdom. He even says, I'm only the harbinger of the Messiah and Jesus says, yeah, you're just the harbinger. But the key difference, and I actually have a paper written on this that'll be probably published later this summer. The key difference between the political program of John the Baptist and Jesus is Jesus, or John the Baptist expected violence and Jesus didn't bring violence. That's the key difference. That's why I think John the Baptist is questioning Jesus' identity in Matthew 11. As a matter of fact, in Matthew chapter 11, verse 12, Jesus says this, "For from the days of John the Baptist until now," notice those two words. What does the words "until now" mean? What's it indicating?
No longer.
Yeah, there's a shift, right? From the days of John the Baptist until now, indicating a shift. It says, the kingdom of heaven has been advancing violently. That is, violent men have laid hold of it. So what's he suggesting? What's Jesus suggesting in that verse?
That
there's a shift that's happening in my kingdom. For up until now, the kingdom's been advancing violently through violent men. He says, but now that's going to shift. What makes him say something like that? It's a cross. That's what makes him say something different than that. He says, we're actually going to advance the kingdom through me dying and through my followers following suit. The key characteristic, though, of the satanic kingdom always is violence. Either violence done to yourself or violence done to other people. As a matter of fact, usually, I do believe some people do struggle with chemical imbalances. So make sure you hear me saying that very clearly. I do believe that sometimes there's just medicine that naturally can cure somebody's chemical imbalance in their brain. And that'll help them with depression, it'll help them with a lot of different issues, schizophrenia, etc. However, I do believe there are times, and primarily because I've dealt with a lot of these people, that there's just stuff that medicine can't help. That really all that it does is just kind of dumb down the senses and even eradicate the person themselves so that they can control the situation. For I believe what's happening there is something much more spiritual. And one of the key indicators for me whenever I'm talking to anyone, trust me, if somebody's like, I'm struggling with depression, I don't immediately think you're possessed or you're being influenced. That's not true. Depression really is a chemical imbalance for some people, okay? You need to be sensitive to that because it's a reality. Every time I hear somebody say something about harming themselves, or they'll say something like, you know, a lot of times I've just been wrestling and what I'm really thinking is it's probably better if I just didn't even exist. That shifts for me. All of a sudden then it's not just the chemical imbalance I'm dealing with there. That one indicator, the goal of destruction, the goal of violence done to themselves or other people, 99 out of 100 times is demonic influence. Not possession, demonic influence. There's something demonic whispering in their ears, etc. Why? Because the goal of the satanic kingdom is always destruction. Always. They'll use the fear of death, they'll use violence, whatever they can use, these two characteristics particularly, whenever it's characterized as something that's in somebody's heart or spirit or life, it's something that I believe is a strong satanic foothold. And we'll talk about more of that once we get going. But that's a major indicator. When you're dealing with someone and they immediately start talking suicidal, etc., you've got to realize that there's more than one realm that's coming into contact at that point. It could be a chemical imbalance, but it could also be strongly influenced by the spiritual realm. Because that's just what he does. Yeah?
What do you think about the trend of cutting that's really picking up
today? I don't think that it's... I'm very interested in several different trends that are developing. That's related to cutting. The whole obsession with vampires is very intriguing to me. The whole obsession with zombies. Now, am I saying you're satanic? No, I'm not. All I'm saying, though, is this. That is the realm in which he lives. That's just his realm. I'm not overly, and maybe this is just, because I'm not as conservative as I should be, I'm not overly concerned with people playing games like zombies and plants or something like that. Like, I'm not like, oh my gosh. What really does bother me, though, is whenever Christians think it's just a cool thing on the undead days to dress up like zombies and to walk around the cities. I start to have a problem with that. And the reason why is because I'm going, what are you communicating? What are you glorifying? I'm not understanding this. We tend to always act like that our actions can be in some way, shape, or form disconnected from the spiritual realm. That's just foolish. But I do believe that the cutting thing is definitely, the cutting trend is definitely connected to demonic influence. Notice there is a major difference between possession and influence. Please hear me in that. I'm not saying if you've ever struggled with cutting that you've probably been possessed by a demon. That's not what I'm saying at all. What I'm saying is that's a very key tactic of the demonic realm. Because, and this is the third element that I was going to get to later, but we'll go ahead and talk about now. The third element, one of the other key weapons of the satanic kingdom, is isolation. It's isolation. That is the number one way that Satan can start to get a foothold in somebody's life. To isolate them. To isolate them by themselves. Notice where this guy is. Where is he? in the tombs by himself. Ultimately, what the satanic kingdom tries to do, you'll start to notice this in somebody that whenever I believe there's demonic influences that could be teaming up with physical realities, is they'll start cutting off the closest people in their communities. One of the key ways of Satan to destroy someone's life, and that's always the goal, destruction, always, whether it be through death or the fear of death, violence to themselves or other people, or isolation, all of these, the goal of these is to get someone to destruction, both of themselves or other people. Okay? That's always his goal. Possession is not the end goal for Satan. That's just the last step before the goal. Does that make sense? His goal is destruction. Always. Possession is just one of the ways he can get there. Sometimes he doesn't need to possess anybody, though. It doesn't even get that far along, because he can just influence them in the ways that he can to destroy themselves and the community. When you see someone isolating themselves ruthlessly from the people that care about them the most, you've got to be concerned that Satan's starting to play a role in this. Just recently, I was dealing with someone, I can't be too specific, but they made a logistical move, a geographical move, that moved them away from a more community-driven area into a more area of isolation. And the more I kept talking, the more I realized it was actually coinciding with where he spiritually was at. It's such an easy tactic. It's just like in war. One of the best things you can do to kill one of the soldiers is to cut him off from the rest of his platoon. Very simple. You get them isolated, they're easy pickings. Because then you can surround them and wipe them out. But if they're with the team, it becomes much harder to pick them off. As a result, one of the best weapons against Satan is community. I have people right now, it's so funny right now, I've had three people in the past week and a half, 2 weeks, that have talked to me, and they basically say that Ozark is selling this lie of community. To which I look at him and say, no, Jesus did it 2,000 years ago. And what's interesting is every one of those people that was objecting to community, the more I kept talking to them, were having moral failures in their own life. That's not an accident. Why do you want to get away from the community? Because if you're in the community, you're somewhat vulnerable to being exposed. And one of the ways that you can keep yourself, your reputation intact, is to hide yourself from the community so you can go do whatever you want. And guess what? When you're in this realm all by yourself, you are dead in the water. You're so dead in the water. We act like that individual sins don't affect the community, and that's just not true at all. The community is one of the key weapons of fighting Satan. That's one of the reasons why his number one goal is to isolate people. Because if he can get them away from the community, he can do whatever he wants with them. And so people will not only be isolated from other people, they'll even be isolated from themselves, which I think is a way of characterizing depression. Do I think every single time someone struggles with depression that they are being demonically whatever? No. However, what I do say is, listen, I know it may be chemical. You need to deal with that, though. Because ultimately, depression could become a major weapon that Satan could use against you. Because depression is not just isolation from other people. Notice whenever somebody gets depressed, what do? Have you ever dealt with depression yourself or had other people dealt with me? When people are depressed, what do they normally do? They pull away from everyone. They spend hours upon hours in their room with the door locked by themselves. Matter of fact, what's another thing they do is they also spend tons of time sleeping, because they're not only becoming isolated from other people, they're becoming isolated from themselves. They feel like an alien in their own bodies. And it all goes back to this key tactic of isolation. If I can get you isolated from other people and from yourself, maybe it'll even drive you to do some crazy things like violence, or even maybe even leads to death. See how this works? It's one of the things I was talking with one of my friends, and I don't have time to tell his testimony, but if I did, it would mess your head up. it's crazy. Where was I going with that? Oh! During this time period, though, whenever he does believe at one point that he was demonically possessed, he said he was so paranoid that he literally would just sit in his room and be constantly hearing voices and be doing whatever. And he was trying to hunker down with guns all around him, looking just to shoot whatever it was that was tormenting him. He lost his wife. He lost his kid. He lost, even from his parents, he became isolated. Matter of fact, he said at one point, that the voices began to tell him that whenever his mom just went away for a vacation, his dad asked him, he said, hey, why don't you go on a fishing trip with us, or with me, it'd just be me and you, we'll just go on a fishing trip, just get reconnected, because his dad was worried about him. And the voices were telling him that his dad had killed his mom and dumped her in the lake, and his dad was going to do the same thing to him on the fishing trip. So what the voices were trying to tell him to do was to kill his dad before he was killed. Or was it you? What was it doing? Utilizing isolation to incite fear to ultimately lead to violence and death. When the mom came back, they lied and they just said, basically they kind of convinced him that this was still a part of the plan. Ultimately, he just said the amount of lies that were being infiltrated, that was isolating him from everybody else, that was even leading him to moments of violence, was Satan's key tactics of just destroying him, his life, and everyone around him. It's one of the, he said it was really interesting whenever he sees somebody randomly out of nowhere walks into a church and just blows away 20 people and then kills themselves. Then they go back to their home and they find that all their toilets were cemented and all their bathtubs were cemented. What do we do? What do we say? That dude was crazy. Or something bigger was happening that we don't want to admit ever happens. But this guy's going, I know why all that stuff was cemented. So because the voices will speak to you out of the drains making fun of you. He couldn't handle the voices anymore. He cemented them up. But the voices ultimately got him to do what they wanted him to do. Kill other people and kill himself. That's their goal. And that's why you find this guy hanging out in a tomb cutting himself. He's using the same tactics. He's using the same rules. It just looks a little different today. Is this making sense? Yeah.
I have like a Hollywood picture of demon possession, but mm-hmm. I never got the point of demon possession in the first place. Because wouldn't that just draw you or the surrounding communities closer to something that can defeat the demonic possession in the first place?
Explain that more. What do you mean?
So let's just say my friend Ryan here gets demon possessed.
Okay, Ryan. Ryan's like, thanks, man.
That never seems real to me, but I mean, like, I would know it happened. But then if I see Ryan, or I hear about Ryan, that's going to bring me spiritually closer to God or Jesus, only because that's the only thing that could defeat that.
Possibly. Some people will worship that. For example, whenever we look in Acts and you see the people in Ephesus, that they knew this girl had insight into the future and would even come over fits of demonic possession. They made money off that. They weren't driven to fear to try to figure out how to deal with it. They were like, how can we leverage this to make more money? Some people won't react to the situation the same way. What you are tapping into, though, is tactics of Satan. Is it most advantageous for Satan to show his head in such dramatic ways like The Exorcist? Or is it better for him to lay low? And does every possession look like somebody's head turning all the way around? No. It doesn't. That's just foolish to think so. If you're Satan, one of the things you're going to do is just like, again, think of warfare. Just like the way Osama bin Laden wasn't killed by us saying, we're coming to get him. Was it? It was using the most covert, subversive tactics we possibly could. And the only time we even knew it was happening is whenever he was already dead. Same concept. Demonic possession doesn't happen in a moment. Doesn't happen in a day. It happens whenever consistently permission is being given for the demonic realm to take a foothold in your life, to come on in. And this goes down to hatred. When people hold on to things of their past where they literally hate people, you want to know why Jesus says, if you hate your brother, immediately leave your sacrifice and go make amends? Because hatred destroys community, develops isolation, and ultimately can lead to things like violence. Hatred, grudges, bitterness, egregious sins, these aren't just things that you got to deal with a counselor. These are literally opening of doors saying, you have permission, the demonic realm, to be a part of my life. And until you close those doors, they don't have to leave. That's one of the things that's so foolish sometimes that Christians say, well, I've given my life to Jesus. And yet the way that you live and the way you treat people, the way that you treat people in your past, I talk to Christians that haven't talked to some of their family members for like 5 years. You don't think that's a foothold? You don't think in any way, shape, or form Satan can't use that? Seriously? What you're doing is all, and I've said this before in this class, and I'll keep saying it again. This hopefully is coming to a head here. All the spiritual world is permission-based. All of it. The demonic world and the Holy Spirit. Holy Spirit doesn't just jump into someone and immediately take over them. It's not what He does. You have to consistently, by the way you live, by prayer, and you have to clean the vessel so the Holy Spirit can have more and more control because you've given Him more and more permission. And one of the ways you do that is by closing the different doors that you have in your life that belong to the demonic realm. I was talking to one of my African friends, and he gave me this illustration. He said, Shane, it's kind of like this old man owns a home. He owns a home, and he finds this young man walking down the street one day, and he says, even though this home is worth $500,000, I'll sell it to you for $5,000. And the guy's like, what's the catch? He's like, there's no catch. $5,000. And the guy's like, seriously? He's like, sure. He goes, oh, well, there is one thing. There's going to be one nail on the back of the kitchen wall, one nail, that's my nail. Everything else is yours. That one nail is mine. You cool with that? The guy's like, for $5,000, count me in. So he sells the home. About a week and a half later, it's a torrential downpour. Just a monsoon-like outside. And the young man who now owns the home hears a knock at the door. And he opens it up, and it's the old man. And the old man takes off his coat, and he says, here, go put this on my nail, please. My African said, and what you have to do is to make sure you've pulled out all the nails in your home that belong to the demonic kingdom. Because if you have nails that belong to Him, He has a legal right to be in your life. A legal right to be in your life. And until you revoke that legal right, He literally does not have to leave. That's one of the things. Well, just because I say the name Jesus, He has to leave. Not if you've got nails all tacked up in your home that belong to Him. You have to pull those nails out. And those are nails of hatred. Those are nails of grudges. Those are nails of bitterness. Those are nails of porn. Those are nails of... You see how this works? Every time you commit in one of these type of acts, it actually nails something in the wall that belongs to Him. And you wonder why He still has influence in your life. It's because he legally owns those. And you're saying, I'm giving you permission to walk in my home. No matter what junk you track in, you actually have a legal right to be here. So what do you need to do? Revoke His legal right. Revoke His legal right. How? Through continually pulling out those nails, committing your life to the Holy Spirit, dedicating yourself to Jesus, and being involved in a community that will hold you accountable to that. In other words, use all the weapons that Jesus has given us. Ephesians 6, you think that he starts describing the different things that we wear in warlike terms on accident? You want to know why salvation is the helmet? You see how this works? One of the best things that you can do in your education here at Ozark is to realize you're in a battle. Because so many of us wake up every morning, step out onto a battlefield, and we don't even act like it is one. And we think we can go around walking around as if we are free from being targeted by the satanic kingdom. And we continually just walk through the junk that He set up for us as if it's not going to scathe us. That's foolish, is what that's called. Absolute foolishness. You can act like He doesn't exist. And that's probably exactly where He wants you. Let's keep going, though. We can continue to develop this over the next day or two. There's some linguistic parallels here that I find very fascinating. Let's keep reading. In verse 3, this man lived in the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. For he had often been chained hand and foot, but he tore the chains apart and broke the irons on his feet. No one was strong enough to subdue him. What do you notice there? Oh, yeah. There's two key words that's being used here several times. Iskaros and deo. What's this word mean? Strong man. Where have we heard that word before? It is the same Greek word. Where have we heard it? Yes, the Beelzebub controversy, chapter 3, 20 through 30. Jesus says, no, A kingdom divided can't stand. I can't be possessed by Beelzebub. If Satan was casting out Satan, this kingdom would fall. How is this kingdom going to progress? If they stay united. So, and that's why it would make no sense if I was casting out demons by the power of Satan. Instead, if you want to rob a strong man, an Ischoros, if you want to rob a strong man, you got a debt owe him. You have to bind him. Once he's bound, then you can plunder his home. And this man who belongs to the Ischoros, the strong man, even when other strong men try to bind him, to debt owe him, they can't. He breaks out of him. The irony of this whole situation is this. When he is bound by Satan, no one can bind him. And yet, whenever Jesus releases him by binding the strong man, then people could bind him, but they'd have no reason to. Ultimately, though, I find another interesting linguistic connection with Revelation chapter 20. The word for not even with the chain, halusis, is the same word that's used whenever Satan is bound in Revelation chapter 20, verses 1 through 3, with a great chain. What is this saying, theologically, significant? What is happening here?
Satan's kingdom is being destroyed,
he's being bound. Yes. The way that Satan's kingdom is bound, way that Satan is bound, is by setting free those that he is bound. That's a symbiotic relationship. If Jesus really wants to establish his kingdom, then what he has to do is declare war on the kingdom of Satan. By setting those people free, by binding Satan, he's actually to set those that Satan has bound free. So, what is it that he is plundering in the strong man's home? What is the treasure? People. People are the treasure. So he comes to this person who is bound, well, cannot be bound, but he is bound, and he will eventually be released, and then at that point he could be bound. Anyway, okay. Night and day among the tombs and in the hills, he would cry out and cut himself with stones. See? Same tactics. So ultimately, coming back to my response to the cutting themselves, I'd say it's the same thing Satan's been using for years. Same thing. Verse 6, when he saw Jesus from a distance, he ran and fell on his knees in front of him. He shouted at the top of his voice, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? Swear to God that you won't torture me." For Jesus had said to him, "Come out of this man, you evil spirit." What is that saying? What is this proclamation suggesting?
Satan knows Jesus' power.
Yeah. That even though he's possessed by Satan, the demons understand they are fighting a losing battle. They get it. So why would they keep doing it? It's kind of the same reason why we still play the football games, even though we probably know we're going to get slaughtered. There's still that tinge of hope until you have 30 seconds to go in the third or the fourth quarter. You're like, okay, we're down by 50. This may be difficult. Satan's kingdom, just because they have quote-unquote lost the battle, doesn't mean they quit fighting. It's just like there's a difference between D-Day and V-Day in World War II. D-Day was really whenever that victory was occurred, pretty much the war was coming to a close. But it doesn't ultimately come to a close for several months later whenever more fighting occurred. And right now we're existing between D-Day and V-Day. That's the point. Just because the major blow has been dealt doesn't mean that they won't keep lashing out. Until they're vanquished at the second coming. Nevertheless, he still identifies Jesus as the Son of the Most High God. And he asks Jesus, please don't torture me. Why? Because I know you're the judge. I'm not just going to give you adulations through monikers that we look at as honorific titles. He says, I know what real power you have. And the calming of the storm is not just it. You have power to judge. Verse 9, then Jesus asked him, what's your name? My name is Legion, he replied, for we are many. Very intriguing. Very intriguing name. I actually tend to think that, although I don't think he argues it well, I tend to think that a guy named Warren Carter suggests something that's very intriguing to me about what could be happening here. Legion, where does that come from? The Roman army is divided up into 28, at the time of Augustus, legions. At about the time this book would have been written, we probably would have been down around 23 or 24. It's not because they just lost them, couldn't replace them, it's just because they go through cycles of needs. But they're spread out all throughout the empire. One of those legions in particular was known as the 10th Fratensis. Tenth Fratensis. Fratensis literally means Legion of the Sea Straits. They initially were founded in a place that was not where they ultimately were reigning, but eventually where the Tenth Fratensis was reigning was in the region of Syria, which would be more north, but it also would contain all of this. You follow me? The Tenth Fratensis. Let me show you the standard of this Roman legion of the area of Syria. The standard would have been their key symbolic flag that they would carry into all battles, that would be around all their camps, that gave them their identity. What do you notice about the Tenth Fratensis standard? What's their key symbol? A pig. That's interesting. In the region that we are located, you have a legion that has a symbol of the pig that is supposed to be responsible for the peace of that region. As a matter of fact, it wasn't just their standard, but it was also even on the coins that were in the region of Syria that were honorifically heralding the Tenth Fratensis. So what you have is this guy says, "I am legion, for we are many." We actually will find out in just a couple of verses that there are around 2,000. In any given Roman legion, there are anywhere from 2,000 to 6,000 members of that legion. Something could be happening here. May explain why they actually begged Jesus to leave the region. We'll get there in a minute. And he begged Jesus again and again not to send them out of the area. Why? Why wouldn't you want to leave that area? Because if this area is dedicated to Roman Hellenization, to the darkness that encompasses the world, it'd be a region that you'd feel at home. Don't just let us stay here. Don't send us down to stinking Jerusalem where you're eventually... We don't want to go. We'd rather stay here. A large herd of pigs was feeding on the nearby hillside. Pigs were actually very honorific because Remus and Romulus, the founders of Rome, Romulus being the primary one, were actually, before they became the kings of Rome, they were swine herdsmen. They were herdsmen of pigs. So the Tenth Fratensis having a pig wasn't something that would have been like gross, like the Jews looked at it, or unclean. It would have connected them back to the founders of the entire empire. A large herd of pigs was feeding on the hillside, so you know we're not in Jewish territory. Hello. The demons begged Jesus, "Send us among the pigs. Allow us to go into them." He gave them permission, and the evil spirits came out and went into the pigs. The herd, about 2,000 in number, so legion, goes and kills about 2,000 pigs, rushed down the steep bank and into the lake and were drowned. Those tending the pigs ran off and reported this to the town and countryside, and the people went out to see what had happened. When they came to Jesus, they saw the man who had been possessed by the legion of demons sitting there, dressed in his right mind, and they were afraid. Why? These are the people that have tried to bind this guy before, and they couldn't. They're the ones that put the chains on his hands and on his feet, and they couldn't succeed. This is the man that all of society said, "Yes, go out into the tombs, stay away from us." And now Jesus is standing there, and he's in his right mind at his feet, and they must be thinking, "What kind of power is this?" Those who had seen it told the people... Those who had seen it told the people what had happened to the demon-possessed man, and told about the pigs as well. Notice what we have resurfacing again. What do they tell them about? Not just the demon-possessed man, but they also say, "Oh, and the pigs. The pigs, you know, the pigs were just killed in the lake." Then the people began to plead with Jesus to leave their region. Why? I'm going to suggest this. I actually agree with Warren Carter's conclusion. I just don't think he gets there very well. The reason why is this. If your region that you are so proud to be a part of, because you, even though you're not a part of the center of Rome, you're on the edges of Rome and you deeply hold on to your Hellenization. If your region is under the reign of a particular legion that has as its symbol a pig, and all the pigs are wiped out in your region, what could that possibly be misinterpreted as? A rebellion. It'd be kind of like us going into Washington, D.C., and somebody burns 2,000 flags. Uh-oh. What's going to happen? Well, the wrath of whatever it is that you just incurred could come raining down on you. I think the reason why they make Jesus leave is not just because of economic reasons. I don't think it's just because they're afraid of him. I think it's because they're afraid of Rome misinterpreting what has just happened and it being an assault on Rome that they themselves don't want to deal with. So instead of bowing down to the power, they say, get out of here before someone notices. That seems to me to make a little more sense than some of the other contrived answers that we've had. We'll talk about the rest of this tomorrow and get into resurrection stuff. I love you. See you then.